Good morning, guys. I love fine art. You know, the high culture stuff. Art with real sophistication. Art that makes you think about the deeper things of life. In third and fourth grade, my friends and I would sit at the back of the classroom so that we could draw during class. We would draw sci-fi and cars and trucks and cartoons and whatever it was that we could imagine. And even though I really wasn't very good at drawing, I loved to create characters and worlds and all kinds of different things. But far beyond drawing, I was drawn to music. The sounds and the harmonies and the rhythms of music resonated deeply with me, and they still do today. So today, as we look at what the Bible has to say about the arts, many of my examples will be musical ones, but the principles still apply to all of the arts. So let's start with Genesis chapter 1. When God created the heavens and the earth, we see great variety. Even in things that are similar, we see great variety. Let's consider giraffes for a minute. So giraffes all have the same kind of coat, right? But even among that sameness, there's infinite variety from giraffe to giraffe. Or if you think about trees, let's look at a silver maple tree. So they all have the same kind of bark, the same kind of leaves, but from tree to tree, there's infinite variety in the shapes of the leaves and in the texture of the bark. There's so much variety. So let's consider all the diversity in animals and insects and plants and trees and planets and stars, and especially the variety of human beings. There's so much variety in God's creation. So how much variety is there in the art that we make? Even, for example, the music that we make for corporate worship. If we believe that God is infinite, doesn't it make sense that our expressions of worship to Him would have great variety? You know, one of the reasons that most of the worship songs that are being written right now are mid-tempo anthems and not orchestral or jazz or hip-hop or bluegrass or rock is because it's hard for us to imagine those other kinds of music being congregationally friendly. And that's why we need artists. We need somebody to write music like that for worship to help us imagine what it could be like and to portray and express different things about God. So, another thing that we see about creativity in Genesis 1 is that when God speaks something, when He creates something, He speaks light into the darkness. And as His image bearers, when we make good things, when we create art, we also speak light into the darkness. Matt Stafford and Isaac Shade and I want to share a story through a song right now that talks about this. This song just talks about how when we make good things, whether that's art or other things that you might not think are art, that we also speak light into the darkness. And this song is by an artist named Andrew Peterson, and it's called Let There Be Light. And I hope that it helps you imagine that whether whether you consider yourself an artist or not, whenever you make good things, you speak light into the darkness. No matter what kind of creative work you do, whether it is illustration or industrial engineering, whether it's composing or cooking, whether it's poetry or plumbing, when we do it well, in faith and in love, we speak light into the darkness. The next thing we see from the Bible is that God does gift and appoint certain people for making what we call art. When God spoke to Moses about the construction of the tabernacle and all of its furnishings, he appointed Bezalel and Aholiab, whom he had gifted in various types of artistic craftsmanship, to head up that work. Then later on in Israel's history, David appointed Heman and Asaph and others to be in charge of the music for the sanctuary. And some of them were instrumentalists, some of them were singers, some of them were composers. And those people were not only gifted to make art, but they were appointed to do it. And that helps us see that art is legitimate work. Now, this may seem obvious, but it isn't always. Many artists have heard and experienced different comments and actions which imply that art is good, but it's more of a hobby than work to be pursued as a vocation. And throughout history, artists have needed to rely on patrons because the marketplace often doesn't pay for art. So why does art get devalued in this world? Well, we tend to place most value on goods and services that are immediately tangible or have measurable results. We even see this in the gospel accounts. While Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at the table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, which was very costly. And she broke the flask and poured it over his head. And there were some who said to themselves indignantly, "Why was the ointment wasted like that? This ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." And they scolded her. But Jesus said, "Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a beautiful thing to me." If we understand that artistic efforts are like pouring perfume on Jesus' feet, that'll help us see that it is legitimate work. Jesus seemed to say that her act of beauty was valuable and important, even if misunderstood or devalued by her audience. You know, art is not something that you can eat or live in or drive or that heats your home, but it's good for us nonetheless, and it is valuable simply as beauty. Now, these days, more and more churches have at least one creative arts minister on staff, and I'm thankful for that. We've taken good strides in this direction, but we can go farther. What if our movement of churches caught a vision to resource the creative arts ministry of the church to do other kinds of art besides planning and leading worship? What if we were on the lookout for illustrators and cinematographers and painters and recording artists? What if we gave worship ministers extra time and resources to compose new songs if they're gifted in that area? I believe that we would see a greater variety of lyrics and music being sung in our local churches. Art is legitimate work. The next thing we see in the Bible is that the psalmists tell us not just to speak our praises, but to sing them. Have you ever thought about that? We could just speak our praises, so why are we told to sing them? Well, one of the reasons for that is because art is a language. So let's take music for an example. Different chords and rhythms and melodies say different things. So this says one thing, and this says something different, and this says something different again. Movie composers base their work on this idea that different art, different music, says different things. And that's why when we sing praises and not just speak them, art helps those worship, those expressions of worship, go to a deeper place within us. And that's why when we sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, that helps to form us in faith. The next thing we see in the Bible is that God speaks through stories in a special way. Many times, God had the Old Testament prophets tell graphic stories to convey the gravity or the poignancy of something. The prophet Nathan told David a story to bring conviction about a rich man who took a poor man's beloved lamb. The prophet Jeremiah wore yoke bars as he spoke to the nation of Israel. Ezekiel lay on his side for 390 days and made a model of Jerusalem under siege to tell the story of her fall. And Hosea married the unfaithful Gomer as a living story of God's love for his bride. And of course, in the Gospels, Jesus preaches and teaches in parables over and over. Why? Well, partly, Jesus quotes Isaiah to show that he is being shrewd with those whose hearts are hard. But at the same time, with those whose hearts were soft, Jesus, who knows how our minds and our hearts work, knows that stories have the potential to reshape our desires. So think about it this way. When we encounter propositional truth, like you are right now, our reason is primarily engaged. And the internal defenses of our minds and hearts are on high alert. But when we encounter a story, our reason and our imagination are engaged, and those defenses tend to go down so that we're more open to different things. And that's why stories have such great capacity to reshape our imaginations and our desires for good or for evil. And that's why we do need to be wise in the stories that we interact with. You know, when I was a kid and I saw the original Star Wars trilogy for the first time, it wasn't just sci-fi spectacle to me. I remember walking into the theater for the first time. We were a little bit late to the movie theater, and so the Star Destroyer was already going overhead. And when we walked down the middle aisle of the theater, I just stopped right in my tracks, and I just stared at that thing. I was captured by it. And it was more, though, as the story went on, it was more than just that sci-fi spectacle. My immoral imagination was stretched. Prior to those movies, many of the movies that I had seen as a little kid were Westerns that I had watched with my grandpa, okay? And in those Westerns, the good guy always mows down the bad guy with his six shooter, right? And those stories did convey certain things that were true. But in the Star Wars trilogy, here was a story that showed if the good guy sacrificially loves the bad guy can become good again. And it captured me. Later on, when I read Calvin and Hobbes stories and comics, I encountered a boy who was a real stinker, although a funny stinker, but he was a stinker who was still loved by his tiger. And when I read The Lord of the Rings, I saw the gospel of the upside-down kingdom, how the weak things of the world can overcome the strong, and how there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. These stories and many more helped to baptize my imagination in the gospel, which helps me love and follow Jesus more. You know, here at Ozark, we include narrative preaching in our biblical communications courses. Not just stories as sermon illustrations, but telling a story as the sermon. And that's hard to do, not only because it takes a lot of creative effort to do that, but because it means letting go of trying to control the outcome of the sermon. If you simply tell a modern-day parable, or creatively tell the story of the feeding of the 5,000, and that's it, that's your sermon, then this person in the congregation might receive one thing, and this person in the congregation might receive a different message from the Holy Spirit, and it's hard to trust that process. But the Holy Spirit does work. He does teach us through things like that. You know, the normal preaching that we do is good, and the Holy Spirit works through that. But he also works uniquely through narrative preaching. Finally, Jesus shows us that the lived out story of our life is the most important art that we make. You know, throughout Jesus' time on this earth, and especially at the cross, he was telling a story with his life. That is what the incarnation is. Word became flesh. Show and tell, if you will. He showed us through his life his heart and his love. And when he preached the good news of the kingdom, that those who love the Father and lay down their life will find life, he lived that out in the story of his life. Now, there are some of you today here who are listening and who feel called to make something for the glory of God. For some of you, it is writing and preaching sermons or writing theological books. For others, it is filmmaking or illustration or composing. And I resonate with you because I feel those callings too. But there have been many times in my life where a preoccupation with making things, even church things, has gotten in the way of me living out the story of Christ's love to others. So by all means, craft sermons and write songs and paint pictures and make movies, but don't let that keep you from taking the time to listen to others and to show hospitality and to spend time with your families and to serve and to comfort. For the greatest art that we will ever make is a life poured out in service for others.